Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's good to be finally back after another long stretch with this cosmically overdue third instalment in my ongoing talk with the one and only Dr. Leah Cardos, the author, musician and co-founder and director of the Visconti Studio at Kingston University in London. Leah's 2022 book, Black Star Theory, The Last Works of David Bowie, was published to great acclaim from critics and fans. And if you haven't got it yet, really, what's keeping you? Go buy it. One reviewer described it as one of the most intelligent studies of David Bowie's music that will ever be published. It illuminates the interconnected web of meanings that are discoverable in his work in ways I have never encountered before. And so in this ongoing dissection of Bowie's 2013 album, Leah brings that broad perspective to bear on these complex and challenging songs. In this episode, we plunge into the final quarter of the album with all its highs, the lows, from dodgy stadium rock to ethereal Scott Walker-esque soundscapes, and take a wander really through the wealth of possible influences and inspirations. So join us now for a bit of air guitar to kick things off and see what you think. That's it. All right. Well, maybe that's what the kill. The three words for this: manipulate, origin, text. And it starts off with this very, very slicky guitar riff. And Slick was on this, wasn't he?
Yeah, Slicky. It's the slickest. It's good. It sounds good. It's nice and chunky and heavy. The guitar tones on this song are
there's
great.
Lots of guitars on this. I think not only have we got Slick, but we've got the other one, Jerry.
It's all right. Did I tell you about when I met him and I gave him a copy of my book and he asked me to sign it, and I was so freaked out at him asking me to sign the book because I write about him in the book, and I was just so freaked out in the moment, and I'm holding the pen and he's staring at me, and I had a glitch in my brain. I was thinking to myself, Jerry, oh my God, is it a J or a G? And he was staring at me, and I ended up scribbling Spooky Ghost anyway because I knew how to spell that. Oh, those weird moments.
In that moment, you can't really say Jerry, G.
But how do you spell that?
J.
You know, it's not the thing to say. Yeah, not at a David Bowie conference.
What was he like to meet?
He's really sweet, super nice. Of course he was. And and just amazing because he was at the Dublin Bowie event.
Yes.
At the start of the year, and oh my God, it was just, he brought so much authenticity into the room. He played a gig and actually played some of the loops that were from Where Are We Now and things like that, and just hearing those elements of the song isolated, and then he was sort of playing along. It was like the real thing, you know?
When he was talking about that, did he come out with anything that even slightly blew your mind or you didn't know? Or,
well, to be fair, when I saw the gig, I missed a little bit of his chatting. I know he did chat a bit about working with David, but I don't think anything scandalously new came out. And then weirdly, surreally, we were on the next day, we were on a panel talking about Aladdin Sane, which was really odd. And then and then his sister came to my talk and he couldn't make it. But yeah, he asked me to sign his book. But it was so lovely to meet him. It was, Bowie rock royalty. And it's, absolutely, and in a way I feel a little bit bad sort of dissing his songs on this project. But,
I'm sure he doesn't mind. I mean, the thing about this, which I find quite interesting, is it's very much set in the world of the early 60s New York folk scene. And there are name drops for people like Joan Baez and Phil Oakes,
Ronk,
Pete Seeger,
Dave Van Ronk.
Dave Van Ronk's
Bob
there
Dylan's
too.
Name check.
I've got a few quotes here. Midnight in the village, Seeger lights the candles from bitter end to gas like bitter end. Baez leaves the stage. Oakes takes notes. Very nice. When the black girl and guitar burn together hot in rage, you've got what it takes, you say too much. So it's this slightly incongruous setting for a song which you think might be executed in a more folkish idiom.
Yeah, actually, but it sounds like Bang Bang, doesn't it? It sounds like something from Never Let Me Down.
Yeah, I think it's a bit more, it feels a bit more meaty than Never Let Me Down. And there's this quote from Slick
on Bowie Wonderworld, which is, from a guitar point of view, there are a few songs that just hit me and David that needed a kind of Keith Richards rhythm. Mm. So I ended up doing just what came naturally and it worked. And then later on, Slick said in the same interview, we were sitting in the control room of the studio listening to You Will Set the World on Fire. And David says, man, that track would be great live. I looked at him, but before I could even answer, he goes, don't even think about it.
Well, this is another one that I think would work maybe better live.
It would be great.
We mentioned
live.
That already.
Yeah.
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 The chorus, I think, is a bit, I don't know, the You Will Set the World with the tambourines and the, yeah. I don't know about that. But the verses I can get on board with, because that riff and the kind of stop-startness of it, it just sort of builds up this nice amount of kinetic energy. I can really get into it. And then I just find that chorus quite disappointing. Sort of, I don't know.
It's a bit kind of pedestrian, isn't it?
Stodgy? Chorus, is that a word I can use? It's a bit stodge.
Stodgy?
Stodgy? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Let's use that. But I mean, it sounds a little bit old-fashioned as well, you know, particularly now in 2023. Mm. I mean, rock music hardly exists anymore. But this style of rock music, this kind of stadium rock, big chorus that kicks in like that, it felt nostalgic back then, you know, for sort of Bon Jovi style. Do you know what I mean? Like it's...
Yeah, it's got that big kind of like poodle rock,
yeah,
poodle hair rock kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, so it kind of reminds me a bit of like Never Let Me Down and, you know, things like Zeros where he's sort of, I don't know, self-consciously inhabiting this kind of big rock moment, but it doesn't feel 100% authentic because I don't know, there's something about it that's too well thought through. I don't know, there's something about this song where it just doesn't quite gel into an amazing thing for me.
I get your point. I do like the crunch of it. I like the heft and the crunch of it.
The
I
heft think it's got, and the you know, crunch. It's got
the heft and the crunch. I think it's got balls. But then when you get to the chorus, there definitely is... It's a bit of a letdown.
When I think about this one, I think, you know, it's suggested that we're talking about Odetta, right? The black girl on the guitar. And the idea of this sort of musical that never happened, this one that he spoke to Michael Cunningham about, in that account that he gave to GQ, he sort of says that there was a plot point about a missing cache of Dylan songs that were discovered after Dylan had died. And so whenever I sort of see him painting this scene and also the fact that the music feels a little bit self-conscious in this almost sort of Broadway way, it makes me wonder if this is a leftover from that storyline just with the evocation of Dylan in the song or his world.
Yeah, that's a fascinating theory. I think the very I can't say this word, specificity of the lyrics would point to that because, you know, why would Bowie be writing a song about the early 60s in New York, you know, and then just out of nowhere putting it on this album?
Well, you say that, but like every song on the next day is like, well, why would he write a song about, you know, Yukio Mishima? Why would he write a song about Nabokov on the beach? I mean, every song has got a weird fictional, no historical connection and sometimes a fictional connection.
But Mishima and Nabokov are far kind of more Bowie-esque occupations, aren't they? This is more like a certain period. But then your point about the musical that never was,
yeah,
that really does make sense, because then, like you say, and I hadn't thought about this, the kind of almost deliberately cheesy big 80s rock effect could well have been composed with that in mind. I mean, that is a really, really good theory.
Yeah, maybe it excuses its sort of sing-along quality that it labours for. But yeah, so this idea of like sort of a musical that may have been about refugees and aliens and also a cache of Bob Dylan songs, and apparently he's dead, but they're discovered, and also a mariachi band involved in it somewhere. I mean, it's the story that Cunningham tells is wild, yeah. But, you know, when I listen to this song, it gives it a little bit of credence for me because I think, yeah, why? What's this all about?
I really like that theory. I really think it could work. I mean, Visconti said it's about a young female singer who gets discovered in a nightclub in the 1960s. Does she set the world on fire? It's not about anybody specific, but a couple of people who sang alongside Dylan. So yes, Odetta.
Yeah.
Quite clearly. Well, does that song set the world on fire. I don't think so.
It doesn't quite set me on fire. But I mean, you know, I like the ending. I like the stabby da 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 da, that bit.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. And the sort of blasting refrain at the end, and you know, how is you set it on fire, and up and up and up, and then da 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 da. It just feels very like the kind of song that they'd end the choreography and they'd all be like heaving, breathing yeah. while they're doing it. It's that kind of song.
Everyone frozen on stage.
Yeah,
like, frozen in position. Yeah. Do, 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 do.
Before we go, like, how are you gonna rank this in the not so good songs Ooh. On the next day? It's not as bad as Boss of Me.
It's not as bad as Boss of Me. I would say I think I like it a little bit more than you do. I would probably put this at the top of the not great pile.
The not great pile, which, let's just recap, is Boss of Me, Dancing Out in Space.
Space.
And this.
Oh, let me have a look.
Is that right?
There's another one as well. Boss of Me, Dancing Out in Space. If You Can See Me, for me, that was one of the less convincing ones. So, yeah, out of those three,
okay, yeah.
I think.
Where do you put it?
I put it, I definitely elevate it above those.
Huh.
And that's because, I just like I said, I like the chunkiness of it. I love the big, heavy guitars. I love the stop-start thing. I mean, I'm a sucker for that stuff. Now I think about your theory about the potential musical, and I think it just slots into place. I think that really could have been what this was designed for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I agree with you. I think it's probably one of the better ones of the best of the worst. It's not the
Let's
best
say
of
that.
The worst. I don't hate it. You know, it's just the chorus that lets it down for me. All right, we can move on. We've sorted it out.
Right. Yep. Okay, so traitor, urban, comeuppance.
Ooh.
That's right. Come on, kids. Boys and girls, mums and dads, you will feel so lonely you could die.
Oh, wow. It's like, I don't know, lyrically the most depressing song, but musically it's transcendent. And so it's the magical combination, isn't it, of the uplift that the music gives you and the self-reference that's embedded in it, which it totally gives it all these new dimensions. The lyric, you know, is that bitter seam through it that makes it great. Because if it was an uplifting song about good things and feeling great, it wouldn't work the same. It wouldn't hit the same.
Kind of, it's a waltz, isn't it? It's almost like a waltz.
Yeah, it's a full-on rock waltz, and it's got strings behind it, and it's got this gospel choir that swells, and one of his best vocals of the late period altogether. The whole thing has been so well done, and it's just...
The vocals are amazing.
They are. They are quite astounding. Everything that he kind of pulls out, the histrionics and the camp and all of that... Lovely glam inflection. It's just amazing.
And then let me quote some of the lyrics. I can see you as a corpse hanging from a beam. I can read you like a book. I can feel you falling. I hear you moaning in your room. Oh, see if I care. Oh, please, please make it soon. Walls have got you cornered. You've got the blues, my friend. And people don't like you. But you will leave without a sound in the end. But you will leave without a sound, without an end.
Yeah.
Oblivion shall own you. Death alone shall love you. I hope you feel so lonely. You know, when I first read this, I thought of that John Cooper Clarke poem, Twat.
You did?
You're heading for a breakdown. Better pull yourself apart. Your dirty name gets passed about when something goes amiss. Your attitudes, platitudes just make me want to piss. What kind of creature bore you? Was it some kind of bat? They can't find a good word for you, but I can, twat.
The dissonance between this incredibly bleak, nightmarish set of lyrics and this gorgeous swelling music. Now, I've read some theories that this is somehow pointed at Morrissey.
Mm.
It's, you know, there are elements, there are kind of like Morrissey-like phrases in here. And, you know, there's something is vile, vile being a very, very favourite Morrissey word.
Oh,
and of course, while Bowie and Morrissey had their run-ins, do you think that Morrissey affected Bowie so much that he would write a song like this?
I don't know. I heard people talking about it. I heard people say at the time, oh, that's about Morrissey. And I remember going, no, that's bullshit. Of course it's not. Mm. But actually, if you sit down and think about it, it's actually a really nice and fun angle to explore, because in terms of their sort of shots fired over the years, you know, he was not feeling friendly in 2013 towards Morrissey.
Yeah.
And all this stuff was going on in the background with Mozza writing the foreword for Tony's autobiography and asking for permission to use his image for his song and Bowie blocking it.
Morrissey wrote the foreword for Tony's book. Yeah, yes. I saw that. But what was the issue about the image?
So there was an image for, I don't remember the actual, so called The Last of the International Playboys. It was a re-release, I think.
Mm.
And he wanted to use a photo that Linda had taken of him and Bowie had blocked it. And so he ended up having to use a photo of himself and Rick Astley, which is fine. But the fact that he blocked it was important. And also around that time,
yeah.
Morrissey asked via Tony if they could organise a duet of the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Loving Feeling. Could you imagine it? And Bowie was against that too. So it's not like he wanted to be friends. And
That could have been amazing.
It could have been.
I was a big Smiths fan back in the day.
I am still a big. I've got Smiths tattoo and all. I'm a big. And actually, I know it's heresy to say, but I'm actually also still a Morrissey fan in a way. In a way, in the sense that up to Ringleader of the Tormentors, I'm really down with all that music, and it means a lot to me.
That was the cutoff point for me too. I think Tony did that album, didn't he? He did Ringleader of the Tormentors.
Absolutely, it's such a beautifully produced album. But the songwriting's really good too. Yeah. I remember going to those gigs. Christine was one of the support acts. It was a really great time. And I love Morrissey solo up to that point. I haven't really followed it since. However, when I sat down and thought about just how, I mean, I wouldn't say the song's about Morrissey, but I say that there's a specter of Morrissey that haunts the song. And it's delicious to think about it in the line of Bowie being a bit of a bitch and dissing people in songs in a way that maybe, you know, could be plausibly denied. I quite enjoy the idea of it. And, you know, the whole sort of suicide line was a really big deal when Morrissey used it in his song. And then Bowie covered it, of course, taking out all the glam tropes and taking out the suicide line. And then if you look at, like, there's, like, behind-the-scenes studio footage of Bowie recording where he is doing the Morrissey cover, and he's definitely telling the guitarist, no, the suicide line, and he's teaching it to him to put it in there. It seems very deliberate.
Well, the solo is coming in. It's coming in where you come, where they're bringing you in is the solo. And then just
I don't know where that is.
Right where you're coming in. it's coming in halfway through at the moment.
All right. So we're not getting the beginning part or anything?
Yeah, we're forgetting the first two verses. Right, okay. I made the thing into four verses, you see. Two sung, one solo verse, and then a sung verse, and then the out, the suicide bit.
Okay.
You're wonderful.
That bit was already in it when I got the thing, innit?
I guess.
I know what that is, you know.
I know that bit. That's why I wanted to do it. I thought it was funny. I thought, what's
the
do? Sue him or cover it?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was great, too. When I heard it, I was like, that's great, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many Ziggy references in this song. I mean, I think a better reading of this song and one that makes more sense is that it's Bowie singing about himself or his alter ego, and it's a mirror image song of rock and roll suicide. You know, we've got this, oh, no, love, you're not alone, countered with the dark image of, no, you're so lonely, you could die. And this idea that, you know, your love and, you know, being loved by his crowd is what kills Ziggy in the end. He's torn apart. On the other side of that is the loneliness that drives a person to suicide. And I think that reading is a little bit more satisfying when you look at all of the embedded Ziggy references. The glam tropes of the arrangement The use of the lyric, which also evokes Elvis, which I think is also interesting. And then the 5 years at the end, you know, how it doesn't resolve. You sort of end with this strange chord and then all of a sudden you've got more time. You've got 5 years and the cycle starts again. And so I think that's probably a more satisfying reading than the Morrissey one. But I do enjoy listening to myself talk about the Morrissey one, because if it's true, then that's just a queen bitch move, you know? And I love that. And this is a guy who, you know, was hanging out with drag queens and, you know, he was around theatre people. I mean, it's, you know, they make an art of this sort of stuff.
It's a wonderful slap down, if it is. And I felt that part of me wishes it was. The lyrics are so fine, almost finely tuned as a parody, you know, as a satire of Morrissey's style of writing.
The moaning in your room or the rainy grey city feels like a Manchester reference. Yeah.
Moaning in your room, definitely. Do you know what's interesting, though? There's another theory. So there's the Morrissey theory. Mm-hmm. And then there's also then, obviously, like the Ziggy themes weave throughout this song in the, you know, the arrangement, you know, it builds up into this almost euphoric climax like Rock and Roll Suicide does, which erupts finally in that, oh no, love, you're not alone. That here you also have that building momentum throughout the song. But then there's, and this is what Tony said about it, was it's about Russian history from the time of the Cold War and espionage and about an ugly demise. It sounds like an R&B song.
About what, Stalin, we presume? I don't know. I don't buy it.
I mean, I think Chris O'Leary has identified it as potentially having a narrative around, you know, the point of view of a, you know, an informer, double agent, something like that, who's betrayed everyone and is hated by everyone.
Yeah.
And takes their own life.
Yeah. I don't buy it, but yeah, I can see it. I can see it, like the Morrissey thing, I can see it too. And and also when you put this song next to what it feels like its sister song, The Informer from The Next Day, they both draw on that Rock and Roll Suicide riff, the three note, you know, ascending figure and going down again. They both do it. And they both talk about assassination and underhanded, you know, sneakiness. So you could pair them together and think that there was some kind of idea that he was exploring with those two songs.
Interesting if it was, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, you know,
that could link of suicide and destroying the self, and then also using spy themes, espionage and all that as well, as a kind of top-line narrative. And a commentator on Chris's site actually pointed out that, you know, the lyric about leaving slips of paper, they said, the image of leaving slips of paper in the park is reminiscent of the early scenes in Smiley's People. And this, plus the theme of betrayal, suggests that this song could well be about espionage. So, yeah,
that's, it could be.
I've never seen Smiley's People, so I don't know.
Me neither. No, I haven't. I mean, yeah, it could be. Again, I'm always going to go with what the music's doing. And, you know, which is why when you just look at the lyrics and a few of the references that lyrics make alone, sure, yeah. But, I mean, when the music's there, the music amplifies and enriches the lyrical text and supplies context. And I feel that the context that's being added by this music is like a reference to like a 50s sort of ballad. It's a reference to Ziggy. It's a reference to Rock and Roll Suicide specifically. It's a reference to Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars album. The fact that it ends with Rock and Roll Suicide and it begins with 5 years. And so you've got this album on repeat.
Yeah.
And those references are sewn in like so explicitly, which makes you think about Ziggy as a character and as, you know, how they brought people together, about how the message was, you know, about don't worry, love, you are not alone. And then also the line, you've been watching yourself, but you're too unfair. And it's almost like the song from Ziggy is singing across time and having a dialogue with this song at the end of David's life, You're So Lonely You Can Die. And it's like they're two sides of the one coin, the light and the shadow. And that, to me, that has so much more detail than just connecting a few words in the lyric that could be spun towards, you know, Russian spies or something like that. But I'm not going to discount those theories. I mean, I think that in a way, I think David enjoyed that his music was, you know,
the ambiguity.
Yeah, the ambiguity of it. Nothing was easy. They'd always throw in a few details that threw people off the scent. And to make it as impressionistic as though people could construct their own meanings inside the song. And I think that's really important. You can't solve it. If you solve all the mysteries of Bowie songs, if you say, well, that's definitely about that, and now we've solved it, boom, 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 that ruins it, right? So you have to leave it open. And that's why they're frustratingly hard to nail down, but that's the reason why they're so good.
Absolutely. But I think the overwhelming theme of Ziggy in this can't be ignored. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's so woven into the fabric of the song, in the structure, in the drum beat, outro and so on. There's definitely a massive reference
He's
there.
Making you want to think about it, right? He's bringing it to the table. Yeah. He's like, all of these images, all these ideas, plus this cool song I wrote, and then these references and the assemblages. Well, what do they do when they're next to each other? What is it, you know, what kind of resonances happen? What kind of constellation can you draw? And I think this is what makes this song in particular, that really bitter line all the way through with the lyric, is what makes this song an amazing song, rather than just a sort of flag waving feel good song. If it had a feel good lyric, it wouldn't work. It's because it's so bitter.
It'd be banal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because it's so bitter, it makes it extraordinary. And it's the juxtaposition, like so many songs on the next day as well, the juxtaposition between the sourness or the bitterness or the hatred of the lyric combined with the sweetness and the sunshine and the beauty of the music behind it. We think about not just, you know, Valentine's Day or I'd Rather Be High, but also on, you know, the next day extra with songs like, you know, God Bless the Girl and things like that, where you think, well, this is or the song about cocaine, which just sounds like a pop song, but it's actually a song about addiction.
Yeah.
There's things like this throughout this period where he's, I think, very deliberately juxtaposing these different feelings and making them sort of react. And it's in that reaction that makes it a good piece of art, I think.
Incongruous juxtapositions.
That's the word,
you know,
yeah.
Like you said, the
incongruous juxtapositions. Exactly.
Just, you know, and just kind of getting off on that dissonance and using that as a tool, as a technique, as something to generate a sense of disquiet or unease. If this song had mournful, dismal music behind it, it would be, well, okay.
Yeah.
But you're unsettled because you can't quite place it. Just another point, going back to Chris O'Leary, he has pointed out, as always, look for the joke in the curse, like the pissy moan that people don't like you, sung after Bowie's already called for the hang rope, or the chord sequence of D-E-A-D, while he moans his final die to close out refrains.
It's die, I mean, die, 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 those four chords. Die. Although, I have to say, that's with a capo on the first fret, so it's actually in D-flat. Which again is a really strange key for a guitarist to be writing in, which makes me think he actually wrote it on the piano. But yeah, or he, you know, he's. I was trying to find like him performing Rock and Roll Suicide with a guitar in his hand and seeing if he had a capo. And there's like a little tiny bit of footage of him playing it on the Sound and Vision tour. I was looking for the capo, even though it's in a different key. I just thought if he's, you know, was he actually thinking about that? And it's just a detail for it to spell D-E-A-D, dead. It just seems to me like such a clever thing to do and such a Bowie thing to do.
Did you manage to spot it?
Well, no.
On the Sound and Vision gig?
I couldn't find it, no. I know he...
And he's not playing the acoustic on the Ziggy concert, is he?
No, it's a 12-string.
No.
Oh, I have to correct myself. I said before it was in D-flat. It's actually in E-flat. So he's playing a D, it's sounding as an E-flat. Yep.
And I just scrolled down in my notes and I saw that Morrissey thing is attributed to Momus, because that's his pet theory. Revenge on Morrissey for stealing Rock and Roll Suicide, for I know it's going to happen someday. Vile rewards for you is very Moz. And of course, the charges of being a sneak, a vampire and a thief have been leveled against the singer as much as anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it holds a small amount of water. It's nice to think about.
It's a wonderful theory just to...
It's delicious.
...think about.
Yeah.
You know,
I like to keep the possibility of it being true open just for my own enjoyment. Mm. So, yeah.
My father and the prison. I can only love you by hating him more. That's not the
truth. Next up, it's Tragic Nerve Mystification. Yes, that's right. It's Heat.
It's a jolly song, isn't it, this one?
It's a jolly song. Do you know what Tony says about this? Have you heard what he said about this?
Tell me, what did he say?
He said it could be about prison, loneliness and sociopathic detachment. The lyrics are so bleak, I actually asked him what he was talking about. Oh, it's not about me, he said. None of these songs are. He's an observer.
I mean, I kind of feel sorry for Tony that he had to be, like, the person explaining to the world about this project. Because you can't win, can you? I mean,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you sort of can't explain in a few little sound bites what all the songs mean. I think, he was dealt a bit of a poor hand with that. And also, like, you know how he went to the press and said, oh, well, that one's about a book and this one's about a historical figure and this one's definitely not about David. And it was like, I understand he's trying to give some context, but with a project as dense and oblique as this one, it's... You know,
dense and oblique. That's a pretty good summation of this track, I think. I got a lot of Scott Walker from this.
Huge Scott Walker, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely those Scott Walker vibes there. You know, my father ran the prison.
The voice and that he adopts, this sort
yes.
of... It's almost like a caricature of, like, you know, the Drift era Scott Walker. And even down to the fretless bass and the atmospheric, you know... dense pads, the dark pads in the background.
I love that fretless bass
yeah.
that Gail's doing.
So slippery, all the way right?
It's absolutely
oily.
Slippery, and it just makes you feel a bit queasy as well.
Yeah,
it's
a bit queasy,
it's not
a bit
quite
oily.
Rooted.
It's a bit, unreliable, slipping around. Yeah, it's okay. it's a great song. I just have to say, I'm so glad that this wasn't his last one.
Really?
Do you know what I mean?
going out on this.
This is very much like a Bring Me the Disco King type moment for me on this record. It's so self-consciously mortal. And I'm just so glad that he came back and gave us I Can't Give Everything Away instead of this, because this would have, I don't know, would have left me feeling really heartbroken. Because it's just so sad and so sullen. And the references that he does weave in there, if you can detect any, are all really disquieting, I think. You know, especially like if you're sort of going to evoke Mishima, who is a person who committed suicide by seppuku. And, you know, you're going to also refer to his quartet of books, you know, in Spring Snow. And then also kind of... you know, say this sort of very portentous thing about being a seer and being a liar with this music and those strings. Oh, just, I don't know, I find it quite heartbreaking, really, as an end to a record.
It is, and just let's look at those lyrics at the end. So this is what you're talking about. So I think this is the final verse. I tell myself, I don't know who I am, and I tell myself, I don't know who I am. My father ran the prison. But I am a seer. I am a seer. I am a liar. I am a seer. But I am a liar. My father ran the prison. It's so elusive and its textures are so wonderful. But again, it leaves us hanging in the darkness.
Yeah.
There isn't the resolution that we find in Black Star.
No, and the thing just slinks off as well. It doesn't really end. It just fades off. Leaving you there, sort of stuck in that mud. But the beautiful, like, golden thread through it is the strings, these two violins, this harmonized line. And they're so high up the neck of the violin that they're like a pinprick. They're like, they're so tight and so just so tense, but so beautiful. It's like listening to, like, you know, a violin being played by a razor blade. It's just so high. And so gorgeous and so, I guess, fraught in a way. It's just so sort of tense. I find it really poetic. And I think that's just such a gorgeous touch from Tony Visconti to put those strings in. And nothing more dramatic than that, you know.
Yeah,
it's sort of this very spare, very minimalist, just enough drama to make it a little bit nightmarish and a little bit tender at the same time.
I know very little about Mishima, but I've seen that there's a lyrical reference to Mishima's dog. Could you colour that in for me a little bit? I mean, do you know this book?
I've read them a long time ago. I went into a Mishima little rabbit hole once upon a time, and I did read the four books. And I think he also put another one on his list of 100. So there's a fifth one that I read about the sailor and the sea. And with this, there's the four books are part of a cycle where there's two people that are friends, but one of the friends keeps dying in each novel and being reincarnated into these different lives. But of course, every life that this person has sort of becomes a little bit more sad or a little bit more degenerate every time. And it's sort of suggested that all the troubles begin with this moment when they see this this dog that had obviously died and near the river and had blocked the waterfall. And they kind of, what they do is they take the dog and give it a proper burial. So it's like an omen, really. Mm. However, that's just the very start of the song. I mean, there's nothing more in the song that suggests any kind of references. It's very like, you know, the other references that he makes to, you know, Carol Ann Duffy or, you know, Nabokov or Evelyn Waugh in the whole piece of the next day. It feels very, you know, he's snatched an image from literature and he's plopped it there for a very good reason. But I wouldn't say that the song necessarily reads as a, you know, as it's all about the book or it's all about Mishima. But in terms of, you know, knowing that Mishima, his life was, it had all these wonderful parallels. And of course, Bowie had an obsession with Mishima and did that amazing painting of his face.
Yeah,
And the fact that his career culminated in this sort of suicide, this sort of religious, dramatic, theatric suicide that he did.
You mentioned seppuku. Mm. Seppuku. What exactly is that?
He sort of, in his life towards the end, like after he'd written books and been a prize-winning weightlifter and is an actor and a model and all these things, he went into politics and tried to stage a revolution, but it didn't work, or a coup or something, and it didn't work. And for his honour, he committed seppuku, which is a sort of ritual disemboweling that samurais would do themselves. Wow. But he also had written about it. He sort of almost prophesied it. That's where the seer thing comes in a little bit. He also sort of fantasized about it. He created works of art about it. So he sort of got to enact this thing that he had kind of signaled that he wanted to do anyway. But it sort of, again, framed as sort of theatre performance, which also makes it interesting to think about in a macabre way, obviously. A fascinating character. Like, really, I can understand why Bowie, you know, found himself obsessed with him to a certain extent. But I think that this song, it sort of, you know, in touching in Mishima and the last song being so sort of caught up in suicide, there is a resonance there. Those songs do talk to each other on that level. But I also found myself thinking about this in a different way after I watched The Singing Detective, which is just by accident because I was watching The Singing Detective because I was wanting to write about Lazarus in my book, and I'd come across it as a reference. So Ender Walsh had mentioned it in a couple of places, that was like a reference that he and David had bonded over. And so I'd never seen it, so I thought I'd go watch it. And it really struck me that the second episode of The Singing Detective is called Heat. And in it is this sort of story that has all of these, like, it's like a lasagna of narrative strands. It's just layers of narratives. They're all happening at the same time. And they're all true to an extent, but they're all sort of different levels. So on one level, it's a book that he's writing. On another level, it's his dreams and hallucinations. And on another level, it's his reality. And he has a condition that can only sort of be treated, you know, once he solves the mystery of his inner demons, once he solves the mystery of his trauma. And so with that in mind, you've got this sort of storyline of he goes back to his childhood and he sees his father. And the memories maybe not be true, so they might be unreliable. And so this idea of sort of evoking the father, saying the father around the prison, saying I'm a seer and I'm a liar, like saying that you can see things, but also you can't remember things correctly. And just the general atmosphere of it all being quite self-excavating and quite psychological and quite delving back into the past to try and make sense of you in the now, feels to me to just resonate quite powerfully with this song and the next day in general. You know, I've really found it, particularly the atmosphere of that episode, to sort of be really resonant in a kind of, again, dense and oblique and cryptic way, like everything else. It's not clear cut. But I really think there's something there.
No, I can see that.
Yeah, especially if he was sort of revisiting it and watching it with a view to taking some of those ideas to a musical, which sounds like what he was doing, throwing those ideas around. So I found that to be interesting as well.
It's a wonderful theory. I really like that. I think that could really have some...
I mean, there's a thing about this song as well, which sticks in my craw a little bit. And I don't know anyone that really talks about this, but Bowie doesn't usually use the word whore much, but he uses it three times, maybe more, in this album. and it shows up in this song. It shows up in the first song. And where else does it show up? In Informer, I think. And maybe in one other place, I'm not entirely sure. But it just strikes me as really odd, like it's jarring, you know? It's like it's like in Black Star when he says, you know, where the fuck did Monday go? Or it just seems really jarring. And you're like, it doesn't sound like something he would normally say. And so in this case, again, that links to in Heat, in The Singing Detective, you know, the main character is dealing with these sort of misogynistic issues in that very strongly, and is you know, how he feels about his mother and how he feels about his wife, and so again, it was just that little bit of sense making that slotted in, which when you put it again on the table with the Mishima reference, with the Scott Walker reference, you know, particularly like the things that Scott Walker was singing about at the end of his life were very oblique, very dense, very cryptic, and to just kind of leave all these little clues that don't quite add up, but the fact that they're there is quite powerful in itself, I think, is really arch and really clever in songwriting, and a really great song. And as I said before, you know, I love it, but I'm just glad it wasn't the last one that we got, because it's so...
But it leaves it...
So bleak.
It leaves your head spinning. Yeah. It leaves your head spinning after this extraordinarily long album.
Yes.
Containing many of these themes repeating, reoccurring, recombining with each other in different ways. And then, you know, you're not quite sure where you are or who you're listening to in some ways at the end, you know, in terms of these voices.
Your mate Nick was right, I think, when he said that there's always a song on the album that points a little bit to the atmosphere of the next one. I think Heat, for me, feels, you know, along with If You Can See Me, I think those two, but Heat atmospherically feels like it connects to Black Star, the way Black Star begins with that kind of really quite dark atmospheric... you know, that kind of velvet quality to it. This song definitely has that denseness to it, and it feels like a continuous thread if you ignore the Next Day Extra and the Sue jazz version that comes out in between.
My father and the prison.
That's The Next Day as it was. That was the album as it was released. And it was a really long album. I think it's probably the longest studio album of Bowie's.
It feels like a long album since we've been talking about it for how long? How many months?
It's been going on for ages. It's the never-ending album, and then
it feels really long.
Good news, we've got lots more tracks as well now to talk about.
Oh, we're going to have to do like a lightning round or something, aren't we? There's another whole 10 tracks.
And that was Leah Cardos and myself discussing the last part of The Next Day. Well, the last part of the standalone album itself, because, of course, as Leah says, there are still a handful of tracks that popped up on The Next Day Extra, which are very much worthy of an investigation, and those will be covered on the final instalment of this series of episodes, which I will promise to put out soon. I do have some time at the moment which I can use to do all the editing and various things that need to be done. So I also am going to try and prepare for you a very exciting interview I did with a bit of a legend back in September, which I really, really want to put out very soon. Till then, thank you for sticking with us for what must be a truly epic endeavour of podcast listening. I really, really do appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you soon for the last and final instalment of Album to Album on The Next Day.